You are listening to The News Project, in studio. Brought to you by GNAT TV.
Hello and welcome back to another edition of GNAT TV's in-depth series. I'm Andrew McKeever, the news director at GNAT TV's News Project, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today on Wednesday, December 22nd. It's also a pleasure today to be joined by a group of folks who've been doing a deep dive into what makes strong communities, and in particular, the role that housing plays in making those strong communities. Housing, of course, has been a topic of conversation in the state, not only this year, but for the past several years. We still are struggling our way through a tight housing and real estate markets that haven't seemed to be able to keep up with the demands for more housing, and especially in that affordable to mid-range portion of the housing market. So with us today to discuss this in an extended conversation, we're really pleased to have with us today Sarah Lang, who is the manager of the Southern Vermont Economy Project. The Southern Vermont Economic Project is an entity within the Brattleboro Development Credit Corporation, which helps organizations turn ideas into effective projects with sustainable funding. Also pleased to have with us today Jennifer Stromston, who is the Director of Programs at the Brattleboro Development Credit Corporation, and Gordon Black, who is the Assessor and Economic Development Coordinator for the Town of Manchester. Gretchen Heveluk is the Economic Development Consultant in Wilmington, and John Dunbar is a member of the Planning Commission in Rockingham, and as well as being a small-scale developer and housing provider in Bellows Falls. So welcome, everyone. Glad to have you with us, and also very appreciative that you made the time for this conversation here today. I guess just to get us started, let me turn to you, Sarah, if I may, and we'll go around our virtual table here, but if you'll get us started here, and I guess tell us a little bit about what prompted you to take this online course on housing and kind of what you've all learned so far. What were you looking for?
Sure. Thank you, Andrew. So the Southern Vermont Economy Project's sort of basic function is to bring capacity to Southern Vermont. And we do that through a variety of ways, trainings and workshops and whatnot. And obviously housing, as you mentioned, has been a huge topic of discussion for quite a while now. And my program had been doing some work with the town of Rockingham on incremental development, which sort of sparked a lot of the housing conversations that was happening in my program. And I've always been a fan of strong towns. I love the articles they put out. They do a really great job of taking complex situations or systems and really simplifying it to kind of the basics so anyone can really understand how a community works. What are the players that contribute to a community? And, you know, obviously their goal is to have strong towns, hence their name. And so they had been really working on over the pandemic their Strong Towns Academy, which is their platform for these sort of webinar trainings. And housing is one of the first ones that they put out. And so, you know, it just sort of fit really well within the work that my program had been doing with the town of Rockingham, as well as, you know, the conversations that have been happening across Southern Vermont. So when we decided to enroll in it, we thought that it would be even more beneficial if we had sort of a study group, if you will, to go through the training and then have some conversations about the things we were learning, which is how this group got started. There's 8 of us total, so not everyone that's in the group is here with us today, but I reached out to the people that I knew that had been having these conversations about housing in their communities. In addition to who's here, we also have Lisa Whitney, who is with Winston Prouty, and Nick Zayak, who is with the town of Arlington. And Jeff Dunbar, who is also in the town of Rockingham and a small scale developer. So that's sort of been our group. We've been meeting every other week. We, you know, spend 1 week going through a section, and then the next week we all meet and discuss about it. So I've really enjoyed it. I mean, I'm a planner, and so it's very sort of plannery. A lot of the concepts are, but they do a really great job of sort of just laying the foundation of like, how does housing get built? Why doesn't it get built in certain areas? What do developers really have to consider? You know, what are the developers seeing when they're thinking about building housing somewhere? What do municipalities have to struggle with or work through in order to have a variety of housing in their communities? So it really does give, you know, a great understanding for us to then talk about what's happening in our communities. So I'm going to pause there because I've been talking a lot and let others chime in, but it's been a really great experience and I know I've learned a lot and I think everyone else has too.
All right, great. Well, Gordon, let me turn to you next. What has been your big takeaway from the online course you've been taking?
Well, first of all, Manchester's been dealing with the housing problem for a long time, long before COVID, at least the affordability of housing. And we have a lot more jobs than we have housing. And so we have a lot of people coming here from Salem, from Granville, from Rutland, up from Bennington. And quite frankly, the teachers who teach here, the policemen who work here, none of those people can afford to live in the town that they work for or work with. So we've been talking about housing for a long time. That's only gotten more. The need has grown because of COVID. If anybody's ever tried to make a reservation or go to a restaurant on a Monday or a Tuesday, maybe even a Wednesday in town, you'll find that restaurants are closed because they just don't have staff. We just don't have the housing to house all the employees that we need in town. So we've been talking about it for a long time. And when Sarah proposed it, it made perfect sense to be involved in it, just to see what do we have to lose by looking and considering other possibilities. That's why I got involved.
Okay. And Jen, what drew you into this group?
Well, it's kind of housing is one of my major interests. And when I was in planning school, I went back to grad school in my early 40s. That seemed like a great idea. But because I really loved sort of planning. Housing was my main thing. But there's not a lot going on in housing in this region, and this is where I live. And so that's just not really what I ended up working in. I got into economic development. But we've had sort of a running joke here for years that, you know, the first couple of years, I would say housing all the time and my boss would be like, sure, but that's not really what we do. So, and then the last couple of years, everybody else keeps saying housing and I just sit there and kind of smirk and my boss looks at me. It's like, fine, I get it. Housing affects everything. So I've enjoyed, it's not great because it's the result of this being a growing crisis that more and more of us are aware of, but I am actually really happy of the growing realization about how important it is to so many different people, to communities, you know, whether you're going to have the firefighters and the teachers, you know, and the childcare providers that you need and the town officers to, you know, that you need, whether we're talking about being able to, you know, foster the workforce this region needs. I mean, the workforce is declining rapidly because folks are retiring and luckily, not all those retirees are leaving. So they're still here. They're still occupying their homes and hopefully will stay here for a long time to come. But whoever replaces them in the workforce needs a place to live. And so, you know, these are structural and systemic issues that we've kind of known were coming. And way back when I worked on the Futures Project years ago, we talked about a certain amount. And I'm excited that we're at a place of kind of growing consensus that things need to be done. I think what's fun about this unit is I learned so much. I mean, I've paid attention to this topic for about a decade, and I learned something in like almost every chapter of this. So I think Strong Towns has done a great job of bringing a tremendous amount of detail. And I think one of the big takeaways, you know, is this isn't a Southern Vermont problem. This isn't a Vermont problem. This is a national problem. And that doesn't mean we can't or shouldn't try to come up with solutions. In fact, it might tell us that we're going to have to, because the solutions that are going to get put forward might be solving for parts of the economy that don't really relate to our rural areas. But I think it's important for us to just start from that and not look around to see who did, no one did anything wrong. Vermont didn't do anything particularly wrong. This is just where we are as a country, sort of a lack of policy and instruments and financial instruments and planning. And you know, there's not really easy solutions. So that's not a very inspiring way to put it. But I think just coming to that understanding that there is a thing that's a problem, there's something needs to be done, and it's not obvious or easy, but we also have to work on it. And I just want to say my last thing, which is I love that a whole bunch of people got together and show up week after week, having read all the stuff and watched all the videos and to talk about this. So, I mean, kudos to everyone who's participated in this, because this is like a lot to work on. But I think it just shows the seriousness with which folks are taking this and the commitment to trying to make a change.
Okay. Well, Gretchen, let's turn to you next. How is this playing out? How is housing playing out in Wilmington? Are you experiencing the same shortages and lack of the right kind of housing that you're looking for, like so many other communities around the state seem to be?
Yeah. Wilmington, we had a housing study, actually. We collaborated with the town of Dover. And so we're calling us more like the Deerfield Valley. And that it did come out of that study, and this is, you know, pre-COVID, that we really needed workforce housing as well as senior housing. And kind of like what Gordon's saying, we don't have the workforce because the workforce in restaurants and hotels and retail can't afford a lot of the rentals that are in Wilmington and in Dover. So it's really difficult for them to get housing. And, you know, this program has been really great, actually, because, yes, it does show a little bit like larger towns and communities, but you can always use them, you know, like scale it down to what, you know, is your issue. And you can take something away from every single one of them. And then the other great thing about this is really learning from the others within the group. So, you know, we're listening to these webinars and then we're bringing back and we're having conversations and, you know, and they're very rich in content. So I've really appreciated that. But one really big takeaway, I think, is it's important for communities in Vermont, if we're small, this is a resort community, it's important to gather together and work, not so necessarily regionally, but at least have another town that you're working with that's similar so that your resources go further. And because the state, no, we're not going to come and get saved. So we have to figure out our own housing issues and figure out how we're going to get the funding to go forward.
And John, over to you then. What's the housing situation like over in Rockingham, Bellows Falls?
Very, very similar to what everybody has indicated already. And, you know, really it's, you know, I grew up in Rockingham. My twin brother, I have an older brother, and, you know, we grew up in a home improvement company, so roofing, siding, windows, and part of my career has been working for home builders, weatherization contractors. So I've had you know, that part of my my knowledge of what it takes to build, the costs of it, some of the challenges of it, and you know, recently being part of the Planning Commission, sort of getting a better understanding of what the town faces in terms of their zoning regulations. And you know, I've been fortunate enough that my parents, certainly to help pay for college for three boys, invested in real estate and have taken on some of that in the last 10 years approximately. And growing up in the town and seeing buildings that haven't been taken care of and remembering them in my childhood of what they looked like and the energy around them during their heyday, You know, my twin brother and I sort of have that feeling that, you know, yes, we would like these to be investment properties, but part of that investment is investing in the town and making sure that you are keeping these buildings maintained and improving them, and that you have an obligation as a property owner to maintain that condition and allow people to live in comfortable housing. And that's, you know, that's been eye-opening between the town government stuff and my knowledge of building trades and energy efficiency, that, you know, there's a lot that goes into, you know, improving these homes and, you know, bringing them up to current standards versus just leaving them where they were at when you took on the building. And so, yeah, I think that's part of the struggle that all of these towns are seeing, is that we have really old buildings and they need some attention, and making sure that, you know, the greatest part about this group is that, as Gretchen has said, you know, we're not going to get saved, but Vermont is certainly a very resilient state, and our towns are very resilient, and that's the nature of being a New Englander, I think. And so, you know, here's a small group of people that are coming together and working together to say, you know, we don't need to wait for the state or the federal government or anybody else to come, you know, help our towns. We certainly welcome that, but, you know, we're going to step up and we're going to do that. And we're going to take these small steps, because each of these towns that are represented here are growing up in this area. You know, I have some really strong feelings about how vibrant and how important these little towns are. And there are some really committed people that will help continue that.
John, let me stay with you for this next question, but I'd love to hear everyone else weigh in and comment on it. Why is it so hard to develop this affordable to mid-range segment of the housing market? We've heard a lot about labor costs and supply chains and materials being more expensive than they used to be, but this is a problem that didn't just start in 2020. It goes back a long ways. So why is it that developers have been so under-incentivized to, I'm not sure if that's an actual word or not, to build that, to respond to that need in the market that's been clearly present for a while?
Yeah, well, you know, it's pretty interesting to think about, because if you really think about the building industry as a whole in America, it's pretty fragmented. And the building codes in various towns, states, or areas of the country are vastly different. Any energy codes are vastly different. But you will, you know, you have such a wide variety of what can happen versus what should happen. If we look at Europe, there are certain countries in Europe that the building standard is at a certain level. And it's a really high level, that there's the expectation that everybody lives in energy efficient housing, that you don't rely on fossil fuels, and that you don't have to have that, you know, each house isn't 3,500 square feet, you know. So when the bar is set at a certain standard and you can't go below that, and there isn't above that standard, there isn't much more. The country set the standard there. In America, we've set that standard much lower. And so it isn't necessarily about really high performance homes and smaller homes. So we've just gotten to a place in the building industry that some areas you might find them building for $100 a square foot, and some areas you might find that it's $300 a square foot minimum. And so are we providing housing for people that is, where does it fit on that scale? Is it fitting into that high performance, low energy, healthy homes? Or is it the minimum amount, which would be code level? So the worst house you could legally build, is it at that level? And we're just looking at it from an investment standpoint. So I think that developers struggle with it because, you know, the cost to do a really good project and have something that's high performance and comfortable and healthy, the cost of that is much different than if I just do the code minimum house and I, you know, do finishes in the house that I know that maybe every time somebody moves out, I'm going to have to redo them versus something more long-term. So I think that's a big struggle is from the cost perspective. From a zoning perspective, there's, you know, rules that towns and municipalities have put into the framework that makes it very difficult. So it could be density, it could be the minimum lot sizes, it could be minimum frontage. So, you know, I did a quick study of Bellows Falls and their zoning bylaws and just the properties that I own and some other vacant lots in town. And 46%, nearly half of the lots in the village of Bellows Falls are non-conforming because they are smaller than the minimum lot size. So the town was built with a bunch of, you know, mostly really small lot sizes, and everybody lived in a neighborhood and you loved the neighborhood feel and you walked to wherever you were going. And now we're car-centric society and need bigger driveways for multiple vehicles. And so I've really, you know, come to understand that, you know, we can put some artificial barriers that will keep developers from looking at a lot and saying, well, I can get three or four units on that, but the zoning code only allows one.
What the rest of you think about that? Gordon, let me go back to you, if I may, because I know this has been a subject in Manchester as well, and the zoning statutes in Manchester have been overhauled recently. What is your takeaway from why is it that it's so difficult to get developers to build lower cost housing?
Well, it costs a lot. I mean, it might have been $200 a square foot a few years ago, but now I think you'd be lucky to get it built at $300 a square foot in Manchester. And in a lot of places, it's higher than that. You know, at $300 a square foot, you know, you're talking about a 1,500 square foot house is all of a sudden $450,000. For a lot of places, let's take Bennington, that would be on the high end of the price range. And that would be a very modest house here in Manchester. There have been developers, and there are developers who are doing projects. In fact, there's one right down the road here from the town offices where there are 20 different units being built on a relatively small piece of property. It's zoning is not the problem in Manchester. We allow the density. And there are going to be 20 houses in maybe about a 5 or 4 acre parcel. But it costs a lot to build. Materials are hard to come by. And it's expensive. Even these houses, I'm worried, are going to be priced out of the range for some of the workforce. So that's really the main problem. We have a couple of developers doing several projects with multiple units. But it takes a while. I mean, the thing that I would take away from some of this is that it's progress is going to be incremental, and there's not going to be a big transformational project that's suddenly going to bring 100 new units to town. I mean, it's unlikely that you'll see that kind of gigantic development. That takes a long time. You know, the Putnam Block Hotel down in Bennington, if you think about it, was maybe decades in the making. We need housing now, and I think people in Manchester want it as quickly as possible. But the town's not a developer. We don't build houses. We try to create the atmosphere and the circumstances where building can happen and development can take place. And we'll do everything we can to assist that. But we don't go build the houses. We don't control the prices of the materials or the availability of the materials. So we're doing the best we can, but it's a slow but steady progress, I hope.
Is that the case in Wilmington as well, Gretchen? Something similar, or are you, is your situation somewhat different from that?
Yeah, ours is a little different because it is zoning, and we actually, the Planning Commission has made changes to density and setbacks in Wilmington, and the Select Board is reviewing, having their hearing the beginning of January for these zoning changes. So, but that's been in the making for about 8 months. It was a lot of heavy lifting on the zoning, the Planning Commission, but that is moving forward. You know, I just kind of want to go back to, you know, Dover. We call it the Bytown. We have a Bytown Economic Development Committee, and then we have a Bytown Housing Committee, which is a subcommittee of that. And we had actually sent out letters to potential people that we might think might do a small project, you know, like maybe 10 units or something like that in Wilmington or in Dover. We sent out 12. We got like 10 responses back. They were all interested in doing something. The problem was, is the cost. They can't make it sustainable, you know, within even a 5-year period of time because of the cost. And so how can we access, you know, we have two large resorts that have Act 250 permits that require them to send housing mitigation funds to the state housing board. And, you know, how can we access some of that money? And, you know, because that money is actually being spent by the housing agencies. And, you know, our crisis is now, we understand that Brattleboro, you know, is having a homeless crisis, and we're sympathetic to that. But we also need some help, and how do we do that? And how do we access those funds? So it's important that we try to figure out how we are going to work with these private developers to build this workforce and senior housing in Wilmington.
This is a question I'd like to throw out to all of you, and I'll let you just sort of respond as you will, but maybe I'll direct it first to you, Jen. ARPA. Isn't ARPA going to be the big transformative thing here to come to the state, and all of a sudden there's a lot more money? I mean, a big chunk of the ARPA money that the state is getting is supposedly going to housing. Is that the problem solver, or...
And that remains to be seen. You know, there's ARPA money at the town level, and I think there are probably some things that towns can do to try to take a bite out of the situation. But, you know, that remains to be seen. I mean, the towns are and should be taking time, because they have plenty of time, to figure out what to do with that money and what they're allowed to do with it and what would be transformational. As far as the state's money, I'm only going to speak to infrastructure. I don't have a sense of what other ARPA money could be used for this. I think that there are, you know, the question is like, whether it's ARPA money or other federal infrastructure money or other big dollars, there are things that can be done at the state level. I think I would back it up and kind of start to itemize what are the ways to nibble away at this, right? You know, sort of back to, it will always be more profitable for developers to build a resort home, you know, build $1 million home on a ridgetop than to build a house, you know, for workforce people. But there are developers who want to do this. I think, you know, the Dunbars and Bellas Falls and Gretchen's, you know, experience with folks in Wilmington, people want to come to the table and do this work because it's what they're interested in doing. They want to give back to their communities, or it's just the business they're in. They, you know, they do want to have multifamily homes or do village and downtown redevelopment. So, I think that there's a mindset that we have to get past, which is this assumption that we should push all of the costs of development onto developers. And so to kind of answer your question, yes, ARPA or some other money should be spent on infrastructural costs, and that can be roads, water, sewer, sidewalks, traffic lights, things like that. It has been the mentality since the growth management era of the 80s and 90s, which was a pushback on an era of sprawl happening, that we shouldn't, the public sector shouldn't do that, that all those costs should be pushed onto developers. And when you do that, when you say to someone who's doing an infill home that they have to do the hookup to the water main and fix the sidewalk and do all kinds of other things, you're adding costs to the site that contribute to what Gordon described, you know, the economics that just don't make it work for regular housing. And it's really not the way that America developed housing. You know, the way that America developed itself in the 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s was that the public sector picked up the tab for the infrastructure and also for the schools and the water treatment plants and things like that. And so it's really not how we get anything big done. So I agree with Gordon that we're going to see not that many really big projects, but we might see a bunch of, you know, multifamily projects in a town, and incremental growth is really where we got started on this. I mean, this, in some ways, this grew out of an initiative that Sarah was doing with Rockingham, which was an incremental development, you know, kind of study group. And that's the healthy way for small villages and towns to grow. But incremental growth still means we have to take some systems level approaches and deal with those underlying costs so we can bring down that, you know, that stack of costs that add up. But I'm just going to call out to another couple of things that don't involve money. You know, we all, Act 250 was put in place about the other half. The Vermont put in place ways to slow bad development, but it didn't put in place enough measures to speed up good development, you know, and that's everything from what Gretchen's talking about in terms of funding mechanisms to move money, to make sure that we can have affordable housing in every town, not just, you know, in the few areas where we can make that happen. It's procedural. You know, one of the things that we learned in this study group was about process delays and the cost of that, right? If you bought a home and you're trying to renovate it and you're carrying that mortgage or construction loan, and it can go through review that takes 6 months, 9 months, a year, right? Even if there's no Act 250, that's pretty normal. You're going to go bankrupt at a certain point, especially if you're trying to do something ambitious. And so there are many states where there is a time limit. You know, if your project review does not occur within 90 days, it's a de facto approval. And what that does is it forces communities and also states to have their processes in order. You know, there's no reason why, if you have a fairly simple Act 250 adjustment or, you know, some kind of permitting you're trying to do at the local level to do something that's not exactly by right, that should take 6 months to resolve that, right? And you see towns that have, I mean, what we have at the table are communities that are really trying to do this work. And like Brattleboro too, I mean, we have communities that are doing everything they can to resolve that, but they're, you know, they're also not given a lot of support around that. And I think this state could invest in hard costs, infrastructure, but also in like these soft things, you know, the folks at A&R and more planning capacity, the planning commissions and, you know, more help for zoning and planning boards to speed things along so that the folks like the Dunbars, you know, the folks that Gretchen's brought to the table and that Gordon brings to the table have everything they need to do the things we want, right? Make the good stuff easy and make the bad stuff hard. And like, we need to at least make the good stuff easier.
So, and again, I'll throw this out to all of you here. Act 250, that Jennifer just mentioned several times there. I mean, I believe the legislature has been struggling with trying to revise Act 250, which is over 50 years old now at this point. What should that rewrite of Act 250 include? If you were sitting in the committee room, actually or virtually, in Montpelier and talking to the legislators who would be working on that, what would you be whispering in their ears and say, or maybe screaming at them to say, you should do this? Anyone?
If it were up to me, if a town has robust zoning and planning, as we do, and as I'm sure Wilmington does in Brattleboro, we've got robust planning and zoning. We've got a full-time person who deals with it. We have a plan that the state could review. Act 250 should stay out of it, period. Let them deal with places outside of the town or in smaller towns that need some assistance. But if the town of Manchester decides this is development we want within our boundary, and it's gone through our process with our boards, with our administration, that should be the end of the discussion. And we get projects that get caught up and dragged on and on through appeals or through neighboring landowners who file things. And that's just unfortunate. I don't think it should be there. Enjoy. I have the extreme position.
So Act 250 actually started because of Wilmington. Chimney Hill was one of the major factors. And Windham Regional Commission was tasked with trying to figure this out. So, so Act 250, I think that it is important to have. I think, keeping environmental concerns, people love to come to Vermont because of our quaint, quintessential towns. And I want to preserve that. And, I understand that. And I think really the key piece is communication. There's several pieces to Act 250, environmental, fire, I could go on and on. But anyway, if they all talk to each other and okay, you've passed this part, but now you have to go to the environmental part, it should be all happening simultaneously. And I think the other piece is our region has the most difficulty. I see other districts having an easier time, and maybe they have, less Act 250 permits. I'm not sure, but we've done a few studies on that, the Economic Development Committee here, and it just seems like ours is much more difficult and more stalled and, lost Act 250 permits. And I mean, it's just like organization is really the key, and making sure that there's good communication going on. And so I think that it's important to have, but it needs to be streamlined. It needs to be revamped. A few years ago, they were doing visits throughout the towns in Vermont. It was very structured. They did not want to hear what we had to say. They were telling us what we needed to talk about at our tables. And that's not taking public comment. And I think that it's very important that they listen to the people within the towns that are seeing all of the challenges with Act 250. So it needs to change.
John, any thoughts on that before we move on to the next question?
Yeah, I actually haven't been involved in many projects that have had to go through the Act 250 process. I don't have a whole lot to say about it.
Well, let me ask you then all about development in downtown areas. I mean, that's been kind of an interesting topic. We had a housing conference here in Arlington a couple of months ago where there's a lot of discussion about development in downtown areas, because that was where housing would be close to jobs, close to stores, walkability, bikeability. You wouldn't have the kind of sprawl issues that you see sometimes. In each of your communities, I guess I'm just wondering, do you feel there's been enough emphasis placed on creating, let's say, a former commercial establishment into housing on the second or third floors, or are there more incentives that could be rolled out to encourage developers to do that sort of thing than we may have at present?
Well, I mean, that's exactly what Manchester is trying to do, and that's where we're placing our emphasis. Let's face it, the outlets are probably if not dying, certainly struggling industry. And all of the outlet buildings are perfect for repurposing as housing. And some of the properties have been turned into housing, and they've been very successful. The town happens to own a good amount of property in the downtown area in Manchester. We have a project underway where we're trying to, it's in the early stages, but we're looking to develop anywhere between 40 and 50 housing units in that area. We want them to be downtown. We want people down there, and we want it to be a vibrant area. So that's our number one priority is housing downtown, but we also want to encourage other housing.
Okay. The other thing I guess, oh, I'm sorry, did I interrupt someone there? No? The other thing I was just wondering about, if you thought, you know, conversely from downtown housing that there's also sort of a, well, for lack of a better term, kind of a NIMBY factor involved in housing projects sort of on the outskirts of towns. Do you sense that there's sometimes pushback from immediate neighbors where a housing project might be proposed that they say, well, no, I don't really want my view of, you know, the hillside to be interrupted by, 20, workforce housing units. Is that an issue in anyone's community or not so much so far?
I mean, I think in general, most people don't want to see more agricultural areas, taken up and put houses there. They don't want to drive down the roads and see hillsides spotted with, and I think that's just generally as a population in Vermont, we want to preserve one of those assets that we have. And that goes back to, we have to increase density in the village districts. We have to add residential spaces above storefronts. We should be doing all of that to preserve all the thing that we all want. And I think about the number of elderly in the area too, and how many of those they're out in rural areas, and when they can't drive anymore, and they don't want to move closer to in town because there's nothing really decent available to them, or it's on an upper floor and there's no elevator, and, all of these things that, yeah, those are the things that we should be doing is looking at, what's our, the young population wants to be in a more vibrant area. They don't want to be stuck out, out in the woods or, far from town that's happening. And the older community wants to be more in. So how do we make that possible for them? And it does go back to what we first started, costs and, sprinkler systems in a lot of these old buildings, if you're going to turn them into housing, they're going to need sprinkler systems. That's expensive. How are we going to get elevators in there? That's expensive. And as Jennifer said, we're expecting the developer to pay for all of those things. And those are, health and safety things that are guidelines from the state that, you're forced to do those. So, if there could be some help and there you probably would have, Bellows Falls has a really nice building above a bunch of storefronts that used to be a hotel, and two out of the three floors are completely vacant, and it would be an amazing building. It's very much like Brooks House in Brattleboro, and much very similar to the Bennington project. But you're looking at a $10 million project. I mean, that's only going to probably go up, unfortunately, as time goes on. So how do we make that happen sooner rather than later? Because that would, those types of projects would be incredibly transformational to a town like Bellows Falls. And this group is, we're not talking about those things, but we also know about the things that can happen right now. Are the landlords that have a vacant unit that's not brought up to code. And so how do we get them to bring that vacant unit up to code, make it habitable, let's get people in there? Or how do we take some of these really big houses or duplexes and how do we get them to be 3 units, 4 units, 6 units, whatever that can be? Those types of projects, we'll get to 20 units going that route much faster than a developer coming in with $10 million to put 20 units in.
Mm. You're using existing infrastructure. You're adding, as as you're saying, it adds walkability, it enriches the existing neighborhoods, you're conferring value. You know, when you invest in a home that is, you know, surrounded by older homes, you're raising the value of that neighborhood and of the homes around it. You know, you're improving the environment for a lot of people. And so there's so many reasons to invest in existing neighborhoods, but zoning came in, you know, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, whenever, you know, and it basically imposed this weird logic on our communities. Our communities grew organically, you know, and had, you know, homes that could be 30 feet apart from each other, or 50 or 100, depending on the neighborhood. And they might have 12 people living in there who are related or different generations, or it was a boarding home, or it might be a single family. And there's all this stuff that, you know, evolved. And zoning's logic is it needs to be all this homogenous use, single, you know, nuclear families should be next to nuclear families, single people should live where single people are, old people should be over here, you know, industrial, separated, commercial, multi-family, all of it separated, and there should be as much space as possible between everybody. And so it imposes this logic that has been kind of holding back our communities, our neighborhoods from evolving. So I think that, you know, one of the things that's fun to about this unit that we've been learning is it really gives some research and technical language to some of these things. So kind of talking about like down zoning, about like basically enforcing low density and low occupancy through zoning in a way that has kind of changed the natural evolution and logic of neighborhoods. And so I just think having like words for this and having someone like show how this is a thing that's happened in towns across America and that there are ways to start to reverse that has been really helpful. I think it's hard for people, you know, when you say we should add 100 homes, you know, to Brattleboro, people are like, where? And they automatically think you're going to look at the farm field. It's like, no, the space is there. It is there. We have one story buildings that came about in the 30s, 40s, 50s that absolutely could be two or three stories. We have single family homes that were built for big families that we just don't have anymore that could be turned, that could look the same and be beautiful, but inside accommodate two or three households. And so, like, you know, this is something that we can do while enriching the character of our neighborhoods, not destroying it. And I think the upside is Vermont has, you know, it values historic preservation. People value their neighborhoods and villages. So I think all of the right pieces are in place to do this well. It's just making the economics work. And this is where the economic developer has to say, like, and so, you know, this is why you need things like TIFs, and you need some way in my town in Massachusetts, we can give tax abatements that are meaningful because we don't have the same kind of educational tax structure. You can't do that in Vermont. So how do you find ways to forgive a certain amount of tax liability so that someone can invest that in a building, because you will reap the rewards for the next 50, 75 years on that building if it's raised in value? You know, how do you do that in a state that doesn't have many TIFs, that doesn't have the ability to do those local abatements? And, you know, what are some other ways to do that? We've been incentivizing single family homes for decades in this country. We all take our mortgage interest tax deduction, right? That's incentivized a certain kind of middle class home. So we need incentives of some kind to get what we're talking about here.
Interesting. I before we have to run, I wanted to ask about a point. I think John, you mentioned at one point about weatherization of old homes. I mean, one of the other points I've read frequently about housing in Vermont is that we have a lot of old homes that are 50, 70, 100 years old, and some of them are, well, they need a little bit of work. Is there some way, do you think, that the state could, you know, well, to pick up on Jennifer's point here about incentive, you know, some kind of tax abatement to encourage either homeowners or folks who might be in a position to fix up some of the old homes to make them more, you know, well, better weatherized or more adaptable to today's families. I mean, a lot of these homes, I think, were also built at a time when large families were kind of the rule, and now people have smaller families in general, and maybe some of those homes that were built 100 years ago for one family could now be converted into two or three family units.
Definitely. There's, you know, right now, Efficiency Vermont offers some great rebates to all Vermont homeowners to improve the weatherization of their home. So whether that's adding insulation, making it more less leaky, so more airtight, And historically, those incentives were pretty small, you know, maybe a few hundred dollars here and there. But in the last several years, they've increased those. So all homes get up to a $1,000 rebate. And then for more moderate income homeowners or households, those can increase up to $3,000. And starting in early 2022, that amount is going to increase. We don't yet know what that is. So there are some, and you know, when we're talking about a $5,000, $8,000, $10,000 weatherization project, which isn't uncommon in any of these old homes, getting $3,000 or $5,000 back from the state makes a difference. It will encourage you to do that project. And that's, you know, there's an effort at the state level to weatherize something like 200,000 homes over the next 10 years. And that is a huge endeavor. And so I do think that at the state level, we are offering some good programs. It could always get better. I mean, the more we weatherize homes, the less fossil fuels we're going to be using. And that'll just allow us to meet our climate goal targets that the state has set. On a more, you know, sort of looking at the structure of a home and how to change the structure, alter it, or just fix it up. There are some programs, and I've used some of the programs locally in order to either, you know, convert a unit or, you know, make a single unit into two units, that sort of thing, or just fix up a unit that wasn't habitable. Or convert something like a barn or a garage space to housing. There are some good grants that are available at the local level to do that. And so, you know, I think we are seeing more of these programs come up. I think that the ARPA funds may, you know, that may get distributed to projects like that at a local level. So, again, I think that's where we're going to see some immediate change is people taking advantage of some of these programs, utilizing those grants, those funds to make those changes because, you know, we don't know if that funding will be available 3 or 5 years from now. So we really should be encouraging and make it easier. As Gretchen said, we got to make it easy for people to do it. And if we can do that, then I think we'll see some more immediate change and keep talking about the long-term goals and the bigger projects, but don't put all of our eggs in that basket. Let's do some small incremental things, get that energy growing. And I think we'll all benefit from that. And if Rockingham benefits, then you're going to see benefits in Brattleboro, in Wilmington, in Manchester, and vice versa. Any of those towns, if we're seeing good things happening there, that spreads to these other local towns, and that energy is just going to, and I'd love to see Southern Vermont just really start that energy and keep it moving. All too often, we see that the northern part of the state gets a lot of that, I guess, notoriety or big projects happening and that energy.
Sarah, let me come back to you here to sort of help us wrap things up. You know, it occurs to me you're the youngest person here in the room, and I was wondering how does the housing issue impact members of your generation in particular? I mean, it must be hard to afford to buy a home. Rents, I know over in this side of the state, they're very high. If you can find a place to rent, I mean, how is this impacting folks? You know, millennials and folks in that generation. And what happens if we don't fix this? I mean, I've heard more stories from would-be employers who said, I'd love to have hired this person, you know, this young 25, 30-year-old person who would have been great for the job, but they couldn't afford to move here because they couldn't find housing they could afford.
Well, we should have started this conversation at the beginning of the hour because...
for another hour, huh? All right.
Oh, man. You know, ask me in 30 years. How this will impact me and my generation. I think we really got the short end of the stick in many scenarios, housing being one of them, retirement being another, career growth being another, families and childcare being another, you know, we could go on. You know, I think I see less and less millennials, owning houses, and whether that's because they can't afford it, and or I think there is a little bit of a shift in what is like the American dream, if you will. You know, I think it has been pushed on us that the single family home, white picket fence, family of four with a dog, a car, you know, I think that has been sort of ingrained in growing up in this generation. But I don't think millennials are typically going that route. And I think that is a mix of opportunity, or rather lack of opportunity, as well as just a change in mindset, being more concerned about our climate and understanding that that single family home, you know, out in the woods where you have to drive 20 minutes to get to work is going to have a bigger impact than if you live downtown and you could walk to work. You know, all sort of very complex systems with lots of different things impacting it. But, you know, I think we are seeing a lack of maybe younger people moving to the area or relocating because, one, there just isn't housing that's affordable. And also not the kind of housing, you know, typically a lot of people, I would say, who I've talked to in my generation, don't want to buy a farmhouse that was built in the early 1900s and have to spend a year, 2 years fixing it up so that it's actually livable. I'm not saying we're lazy. I just think that's just typically not what we want to get into. And also it costs money. you know, and I think that sort of points back to a lot of what we've been learning about is that in order to have, you know, all of this different types of housing, you're going to see a lot of variety and diversity in the people that are in your communities. You know, if you are only going to allow single family homes, then you are only going to see the kind of people that can afford to or want to live in single family homes. So if you want to have a variety of people, a variety of ages, a variety of ethnicities and cultures, you really have to expand the housing options and sort of get creative and think outside of the box. But also it's types of housings that have already been done before. You know, there's really nothing out there that hasn't been tried. So, you know, the accessory dwelling unit in the backyard, like that's been done before, but for some reason that seems to be like a, you know, a new fresh idea here. And I see people taking it on, which is great. And I think something that I've taken away, especially from this course, is that learning that cities traditionally have been built by many hands. Many different people have contributed to the housing stock early on, and that's just not the case anymore. And I think a lot of people, especially my age growing up, you know, when I see housing getting built, it's like, I think of that developer, you know, that it is their job to build these houses, and that's not how it was done. And I think in order to get the units that Vermont is saying that we really need everyone to contribute. You know, we need the teacher and we need the police officer and, you know, we need the lawyer and the banker to all think about how can I provide housing in my community and not wait for the big developer to swoop in and build 50 units. Because I think Jeff mentioned earlier, we're going to get to a large number of units a lot faster if we all take on one or two instead of waiting for that big developer. So I think for people watching this, like that would be my takeaway, is to consider how you can help provide housing. And if it's, you can't actually do the housing or provide it, how can you help contribute to the conversation to make it possible for anyone who wants to being able to do it, I think is the most important takeaway for me.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there for today. Certainly an interesting subject, and one I'm highly confident we'll be hearing a lot more about as we go forward, and interesting to see what the legislature might come up with when they reconvene in a couple of weeks up in Montpelier to tackle this. Anyway, thank you all very much for being with us today and carving the time out of your schedules to have this conversation. I want to thank Cyril Lang, the project manager for the Southern Vermont Economic Project, Jennifer Stromston of the Brattleboro Development Corporation, Gordon Black, Assessor and Economic Development Coordinator for the Town of Manchester, Gretchen Haverluck, Economic Development Consultant for Wilmington, and John Dunbar, member of the Planning Commission in Rockingham. Thank you all very much for being with us today. And to our audience, thank you for being with us as well. I hope you found our program interesting. And, well, Happy New Year. We'll see you in 2022. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.